From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The countdown is on. We are 30 days out from Super Bowl 53 jumping off at Atlanta's Mercedes-Benz Stadium. But before the tackles and touchdowns and traffic, the Super Bowl committee and the arts advocacy group Wonderoot are sprucing up the city with 30 new murals highlighting the city's civil rights and social justice legacy. GPB's Ross Terrell reported on the initiative and is joining us now in the studio. Good morning, Ross.
Good morning, Virginia.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. And Chris Appleton is also here. He's executive director of Wonderoot. Hello, Chris.
Good morning.
Well, Chris, I'm going to start with you. The initiative is called Off the Wall, Atlanta's City Rights and Social Justice Journey. How'd you come up with that theme?
Well, Off the Wall originated in the fall of 2017 in the wake of some work that Wonderoot had been doing in the English Avenue and Vine City communities around community identity and community storytelling. And some residents and community partners started asking questions around, oh, Super Bowl is coming to Atlanta in a year and a half. What are the stories that are going to be told about our neighborhoods? What are the stories that are going to be told about Atlanta? And as we began pulling on that thread and investigating that further, what really surfaced was a desire to connect Atlanta's rich civil rights legacy to the contemporary struggles for justice in Atlanta and beyond.
And those are some of the neighborhoods around the stadium near English Avenue. You mentioned Sweet Auburn Avenue in the Vine City neighborhood. So for the On Second Thought listener who may not know these areas, how do murals fit into the whole fabric of those communities?
Well, public art has murals in particular, I think, have an interesting history in Atlanta in recent years. There's been a lot of debate and controversy around how murals emerge, what murals signal, how they can both preserve the integrity and cultural legacy of a neighborhood, and how they can erode or begin to signal some changes in that. And with Off the Wall, we have been very committed. It's central to Wonderoot as an organization, been around for 15 years. We've been committed to ensuring that the artworks, whether they're, as you mentioned, in the English Avenue, Vine City neighborhoods, on the Atlanta University Center campus, downtown Atlanta, Sweet Auburn District, that they are reflective of the stories, desires, struggles, experiences that residents and stakeholders within those particular communities have experienced.
Well, legacy was on the mind of the mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, about the project. Ross spoke with her. Here's what she had to say.
As we prepare our city for great events like the Super Bowl, it's important that these events have a lasting legacy within our communities. And that's what these murals are all about.
Ross, ahead of last year's game in Minneapolis, $4.5 million were donated to local organizations to fight hunger, build playgrounds. So are there other community initiatives in Atlanta in addition to art?
Yes, this is just one pillar. The Super Bowl committee also actually rolled out a number of things. Businesses, investing in minority-owned businesses, civil rights and social justice, sustainability when you talk about recycling, bringing that to these neighborhoods that you know may not partake, and then youth engagement, focusing on child nutrition, increasing play. So art is just kind of one factor of a total legacy package.
Well, municipalities often pretty up the place before big events like this, and they're often targeted by critics for that. Artists are out there painting now. What have you heard from residents about this public art?
I think it's kind of twofold. For one, as Chris mentioned, as you mentioned, it looks nice. I mean, it's fresh paint on walls near abandoned buildings and areas that you may drive by and have never looked at, and now there's a new painting. But it's also taken with a grain of salt, as in, okay, you can invest in this. Where was this 6 months ago? Hmm. Why wait till the big game? And also, why not put this money toward other things? Roads, sidewalks, schools. So the issues that the city deal with, they don't end when the game ends and they don't start when the game gets here. And people want to see investment in an attempt to correct those issues.
Well, some of these neighborhoods have seen hard times and socioeconomic challenges. And many who live there may not be able to afford a Super Bowl ticket or even a visit to a museum. So what is the importance of art in these neighborhoods, Chris?
So Off the Wall is an initiative that is rooted in catalyzing and further amplifying the existing social justice, civil rights, and human rights organizing that's going on in Atlanta. Public art affects change because public discourse is necessary for social change to occur. Mm. And when you concentrate a large number of artworks that are rooted in a central theme or central message into a relatively small geography like we are with Off the Wall, you have the opportunity to shift public discourse, which can affect public policy and affect lasting change, I think, that is necessary for Atlanta. We worked with 43 different community organizations, from Ebenezer Baptist Church to Georgia Equality to Westside Works and Freedom University. Westside Works is a job training program for residents that live on the West Side near the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and Freedom University is a freedom school for undocumented students. And those 43 different organizations that are really on the front lines of doing civil rights and human rights organizing asked their stakeholders, their constituents, four pillar questions. We worked with a civil rights historian, Karshik Sims Alvarado, and an activist, artist, and professor at Emory, Carlton Mackey. They developed a facilitation guide that asked four pillar questions. And those questions are, with whom and for whom do you struggle for justice? Mm-hmm. What are your fears in the struggle for justice? What are some of the untold or unheard stories that should be lifted up? And if your communities did not have to struggle for justice, what might they look like? And our 11 artists sat in the rooms to listen to that dialogue, and that's what informed and inspired the murals that we're seeing now all over the city.
So really a lot to corral here, and much bigger than an art project.
Much bigger than an art project,
What is yes. the budget for it?
Several hundred thousand dollars.
Who's paying for it?
Usual suspects. So Wonder Root has been out pounding the pavement, raising money from local businesses. There's no funding coming from outside of Atlanta for the project. I think one of the common misconceptions is that somehow this is a NFL-led or NFL-commissioned initiative. We have not been partnered with the NFL. They're not involved with the project. And really, we see the Super Bowl as a galvanizing or catalytic moment to really leverage the attention that is on Atlanta and that Atlanta itself is trying to harness as a city. And that's why we're engaged with the Super Bowl.
We did get a comment on our GPB page from a listener using the name Atlanta Living, who said, quote, "The NFL is a smart PR machine. This is no accident. Without Kaepernick, there is no call for these murals." So you must have heard this. You've been hearing from people who say this shouldn't be a moment for social justice messages.
Well, I think we all have our part to do in elevating social justice storytelling and catalyzing movements for justice. And we need, quite frankly, I believe, everyone to be engaged in discussions around social justice, including the Super Bowl and the NFL.
Chris Appleton there. He's executive director of Wonder Root, and he's talking about the Off the Wall project. This is 30 murals that are being painted in Atlanta in time for this Super Bowl. GPB's Ross Terrell is also with us. He's been reporting on the project. There are 11 artists, roughly 30 murals planned. And Ross, you spoke with one artist, Muhammad Youngguy, who's working on three murals, including Community Roots. This is in Atlanta's Castleberry Hill neighborhood. Here's a little bit from your conversation.
I can't solve all of the problems of Atlanta or depict all of the problems of Atlanta or social injustice in just three murals. So the key is to find things that are important to me.
So, Ross, how did the artists, especially those not from Atlanta, get input from the community and find out what is important?
Yeah, in this particular conversation, Muhammad was speaking with students at Spelman, which is an all-women's HBCU. And one of the things that I found really interesting about that conversation was most of the students weren't from Atlanta. They had came here from college, so they had a really unique perspective of where they had come from, whether it be the Bronx, Inglewood, and then some of the things they were seeing here and how that compares. You talk about a guy like Muhammad, he's from a New Orleans native, but he grew up here. And he was actually a person who was boycotting the NFL because of the Kaepernick situation. So he saw this as a chance to not only start back watching the game, but this a matter of how can I get involved? I don't like how something is going. This is my chance to kind of have an input and take an event like the Super Bowl and send a message.
Here's another clip from him talking with students at Spelman.
But I do have a challenge of wanting to balance the optimism of what I want art to be with the realness of what the issues are. Mm-hmm. And so either way, it's an opportunity.
The realness of what the issues are. And that's interesting. I mean, how a lot of people who may even be from Atlanta, never mind those who are from someplace else, may not really know a lot of the characters in the civil rights history here in Atlanta.
Right. And I think with Muhammad, in these conversations, he has daughters. He is a teacher. He used to paint murals in schools. So he likes to wake up in color. So he really saw this as a chance. When I was actually looking for him while he was painting, I completely drove by. I didn't know where he was. And when I finally got there, he said, that's the point. I want you to stop. I want you to see these. I want you to ask questions. Where this used to be a wall with a few holes, now you have something to talk about. Why are the HBCU students holding vegetables?
Well, murals do add a lot of color to the walls all over the city. And in 2017, Chris, you alluded to this, Atlanta City Council members considered an ordinance that would have regulated murals more strictly, led to a huge outcry over free speech. And leaders actually ended up voting down the proposal. That debate was a sign that not everyone is on board with just any mural going up around town. So, Chris, how are you getting the community to weigh in on the real content and location?
So we would be one of those organizations that not just any mural should go in any neighborhood. So after the 43 different community conversations that we had, artists submitted their designs. And in our contracts with artists, artists are required to complete revisions and edits of the artwork if requested. And so what we ended up doing was taking those designs, printing them on posters and having community feedback events where in the neighborhoods where the murals were to be installed, we invited the public out. They filled out comment cards. We had hundreds of comment cards filled out that said, I love this, or yes, this does reflect my neighborhood, but it's not the stories that should be told about my community, or this doesn't reflect my neighborhood. And we then took that and we synthesized and packaged up all that information, shared it back with the artists, and the artist edited and revised their designs, resubmitted those. We had another round of community feedback. We went back to the artist a second time, and that's how we ended up at the final designs. And so we think that that's the practice that artists working in the public realm should have all the time, that they should be engaged with residents, the people who are most affected by the artwork and the issues that the artworks are speaking to.
So this is going to remain long after the game is over. How do you consider the legacy of this particular kind of art?
Well, we think that this is a project that is consistent with the kind of work that Wonderit has been doing in its 15-year history. It is a contribution to ongoing struggles for justice and equality in Atlanta and beyond. And we feel confident that Wonderit, our partners, and others will continue to do this kind of work long beyond the Super Bowl.
Chris Appleton, he's executive director of Wonderit. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck getting this project done in the rain.
Thank you.
And GPB reporter Ross Terrell, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, later in the show, we're going to talk about places where history is being shown, in many cases revised, to show a fuller picture. But first, testing prospective voting machines. That and more coming up when On Second Thought continues after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Culinary historian Michael Twitty traces his ancestry, both black and white, through food. His memoir, The Cooking Gene, won the 2018 Beard Foundation Award for Book of the Year. In it, Twitty asks the question, who owns Southern food? GPB's Tony Harris asked Twitty why he wanted to wrestle with that topic.
You know, that's a really good and provocative question. Who owns Southern food? What do you say to people who will hear that and want to know? First of all, is that really a question? Is that something to be debated?
Well, we all know who owned black people in 1860, don't we?
Okay.
So ownership is, you know, in a capitalist society, ownership and fences are very important. We're learning that the hard way, aren't we? Mm. So I would say that my answer is very nice and philosophical. And it goes like this. Who owns Southern Food? Whoever is going to take responsibility for owning its past, maintaining its present, and securing its future in a positive and forward-leaning way. So it's not, for me, it's not about whether your phenotype is European or African or in between or native or anything else. It has to do with your values and how you look at the history of the food. And understand that Southern Food is a billion, multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah.
But it came at a tremendous, tremendous human cost. And if we don't acknowledge that and acknowledge the other surrounding issues, economics, health, racial reconciliation, we're not doing our job.
Culinary justice. You want culinary justice. What does that mean?
Well, culinary justice is what happens when people who have been historically oppressed are able to reap the full benefit of their cultural production through food. And it means giving people of color, poor folks. I mean, we're seeing an up. I want to make sure everybody knows that we're already seeing an uplift in terms of poor white Appalachian foodways. And yet, the same issues are there that they are in the African-American community in the South. Mm-hmm. Not being able to get, you know, brick-and-mortar businesses, not being able to take advantage of certain spaces, having that food be represented outside the community in different ways than it is within the community, the lack of support for the knowledge bearers of those food traditions. So for me, culinary justice has a lot to do with quote-unquote race, but not everything to do with quote-unquote race. It affects anybody and everybody whose food tradition is, unfortunately, not a means of uplift.
When you were researching Cooking Gene, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about food?
I think people don't understand how many ways food affects, you know, decisions. For example, let's do a quick run through history of slavery and food. Sugarcane is really the catalyst crop of slavery. So in other words, put it like this. Somebody living 10,000 years ago in New Guinea who had every human being has a sweet tooth because that's a natural thing. You know, that's part of our makeup, evolutionary makeup, to look for sweet things, for energy. Mm-hmm. So that person was thirsty. They cracked open a reed that tasted really sweet. They began to domesticate it. The people in New Guinea say that the sugarcane is part of the root of humankind. So there's this thing where the food becomes part of the family tree. So if you're Native American, it's corn. If you're from Eastern Nigeria, where the ancestors of 25% of all African Americans came from, mm-hmm. it's the yam. But just that idea that one day someone had a sweet tooth, and that plant crossed the globe, and eventually led to, let's grow a lot of that.
Yeah,
Native Americans won't be our enslaved people. Let's go get Africans, and that's when the story begins.
So, Michael, this is amazing to me. So, as a person who doesn't view food, and I see this as a bit of a failing of mine, right? As a person who doesn't view food through kind of a historical lens, as symbolic of things, who didn't grow up seeing the narrative of food as clearly as you do, explain to me and others like me what we've been missing all this time.
You know something, it's these what I call food prints. You know, it's more than just, I think well, the first problem we have is that in our culture today, we rarely get beyond three generations of cultural and familial memory. In the past, even without, you know, literacy, without computers, without digitizing things, people's memory was a lot longer. And so those narratives really sustain people through a lot of tragedies and through a lot of failures. But it really goes down to that. I mean, I'm Jewish also, and people find that to be exotic, and I personally don't. And, you know, every year, Passover, you know, eating those symbolic foods. But also just the meal itself, people bringing things that have been a part of their family's existence for several hundred years and being able to tell stories around them. Well, as African-American, I do the exact same thing, mm-hmm. You know, that Sunday dinner context, with that reunion context. I mean, these foods have memory attached to them. Why do we eat that?
Right.
Because so-and-so in the country, and we did this, and we did that. Having that sort of contextual background that you're told by your elders that you can pass on to your children makes all the difference in the world. It is part of the flavor of the food.
What do you want people to ultimately take away from reading this book?
Well, I want people to understand it's really hard. that word American is a loaded term for us, and it's not easy to connect to. It's also not easy to connect to the word African. You're kind of caught suspended, you know, suspended animation, you know, like a piece of watermelon and Jell-O salad. For African Americans, this book tends to be a blueprint, a guide for finding their own culinary story and their own genetic story. Mm. For living history people, it's like okay, when you do interpretation of slavery, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. And for food historians, people interested in Southern food, it's this is the story from our perspective.
Yeah.
Lend me your ears.
That's James Beard award-winning author Michael Twitty speaking with GPB's Tony Harris. Their conversation was featured in the Bitter Southerner podcast, a collaboration between GPB and the Bitter Southerner magazine. You can find more episodes at bittersoutherner.com. Now we're heading into the kitchen for our occasional series, Main Ingredient. We invite chefs to talk about one essential Southern ingredient. Savannah Sasser is executive chef at the Expat in Athens.
I'm Savannah Sasser, and I am the executive chef of the Expat.
And you are originally from Montgomery, Alabama?
I am. Very few people get that correct. It's awesome. Most people think I'm from Pittsburgh, but yes, I was born in Montgomery. I'm a military brat, so I left when I was going into middle school and moved to south of Atlanta, and then when I turned 18, I left for Pittsburgh.
What did you grow up eating in Montgomery, Alabama?
Oh, I always laugh, and my mom is always thrilled at this story. I mean, she was a single parent, so she taught us eating is much more than just what's on the plate. As long as we had a protein, a vegetable, and a starch, that was good. You know, for the most part, it was just, you know, how's your life going? What's going on? She was, you know, constantly working as a single parent, so food was something I developed when I went to culinary school, but kind of understood the importance of eating. After my stepdad died and all that, I helped take over that role. So,
but you were cooking in Pittsburgh for a while, and I wondered about that. You've come back to the South, and Southern cooking and French cooking, you've kind of created this French Southern, I'm not going to say fusion, okay?
Thank you.
What would you call it?
No, it's doing French technique, which to me, most cooking is French technique, but bringing in the agriculture system that the South has. And we have such a great agriculture system. Why wouldn't you use it and kind of play with it in different ways? But, you know, I think French cooking is so rich and beautiful, and just in grading farms and produce, that it's very simple.
Well, you talked about incorporating local food. So your ingredient is
sorghum.
What even is it?
So it's in the grassroot family. When most people think of sorghum, they think of molasses, but it's much subtle and it's not as sweet. It gives a different flavor. It gives a herbal flavor that you don't get when you have molasses. And we actually use the seed here as well, because when you pop it at a high level, it turns into little popcorns. And so you get this textural bite that is so tiny and awesome, and we do it over our crepes. So it's kind of, again, introduced. So we do a crepe cake with this popped sorghum for texture, so you're getting this beautiful French crepe cake and then a little bit of popped sorghum.
How do you source your sorghum? How do you find out who's growing it here and where you get it?
Your purveyors are very good at that, but we have different programs with Collective Harvest here, similar to what they had, a turnip truck in Atlanta, where they pull from smaller farms that don't necessarily have enough to be picked up by large purveyors. And then we just get to know our farmers. We have two gentlemen that run Bartram Trail, and just making friendships with them and having them come in and then being able to buy whatever extra produce that they have.
So how do you buy it? Do you buy it already processed into that kind of molasses-y like syrup, or do you get the seeds? What do you do?
I personally do both. I have the seeds and the syrup. Like right now we just did a sorghum ice cream base today, and then so we put the syrup in after we made almost like a creme anglaise, and then we pop the sorghum every day.
In order to really believe you, we might have to try it. Oh. I think, you know,
just to be sure.
Should we go to the kitchen? Can you show us some sorghum?
And, yeah.
Okay.
Welcome to my tiny little humble abode. Joseph, did you already churn the sorghum ice cream? It's churning right now. I can take you to the front and show you the ice cream,
okay.
And then we can come back and I can fry some sorghum up for you guys to try.
Okay.
The syrup in it, as well as a little bit of the sorghum bourbon that we have.
Oh, it's delicious.
So it's not overly sweet. You get a little bit of the herbaceous, a little bit darker sugar versus just like a granulated sugar, almost like brown sugar.
Very subtle. So when you're testing this, like how long does it take you to get to this point where it's the right recipe?
When you're doing an ice cream like this, you just kind of play around because, as you know, alcohol does not freeze, so you can't add too much or else it won't ever set up on you. So, honestly, we just came up with this today and kind of played around with it. Once you have a good base, like a creme anglaise, I like to do an egg base. It kind of gives it a creamier and it thickens a lot better for you. But, yeah, I just kind of play around with it. And it's easy to do before you churn it. You know, sometimes you can have ice cream and automatically, like, this is not going to work out. I can tell. It's not thick enough. It's not, the flavor profile's not there, so.
Tell me how you discovered sorghum. I don't think I've asked you that.
I discovered sorghum when I came back south to Georgia. In culinary school or French, no clue what sorghum was. I just had a purveyor walking around and at a farmer's market, and I tasted it. And it had such a different flavor profile to molasses, because molasses to me can just be super, super sweet, where this had almost like an earthy flavor to it, and it's easier to pair in my personal without making it super sweet and becoming overpowering to whatever you're using it with.
There's a little baby sorghum seed.
Yeah.
So does that come like from the top of the grain stalk? I'm just sort of imagining, right? And you're going to put it in a deep fryer.
A little bit. We put it in our nut mix for upstairs for the cocktail area. So we do peanuts, cashews, pecans, brown sugar, a little bit of cayenne, and then little baby pop sorghum.
Mmm.
So texturally, it's fun. And you would never know.
Oh, it's so good. So interesting.
Yeah, and you really don't see it. Everyone is kind of always been like, let me see that.
It's so delicious. It's so tiny that the flavor is kind of concentrated because you don't get the starchy puffiness. And it's sort of sweet and not sweet at the same time. It's really delicious.
Thanks.
I'm going to eat a lot of it.
But you can.
Yeah, you can.
So you talked a little bit about applying French technique, which is cooking. I'm thinking about the new world and the old world, right? That there were French traditions that came across to the United States when it was a young country, but they didn't necessarily have the same kind of ingredients. And Southern food is, a lot of people talk about it as, yes, local, but improvisational. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that, how that's worked.
I mean, I think that is very accurate. I think you see when everyone typically thinks of French coming to America, they think of New Orleans, because that's a different type. I tend to stay away from that and stay towards the more traditional, but using ingredients that, you know, that they're being kind of brought back, like rabbit. We do a dish that's braised rabbit with nudi, which is a ricotta and gnocchi almost. And we always laugh that it's like a French chicken and dumplings. And we didn't know if people were going to enjoy it. You don't see rabbit a lot on menus. I did a rabbit terrine that sold really well, and then we put that on the menu, and it was comfort food for people, which I think when you think of the South, you think of comfort food. So it was kind of bringing those traditional of braising. And rabbit is very traditional to French cooking as well, and we source it from Mississippi. Man's Farm, a woman grows some rabbits out there. So that's kind of my take on bringing French and Southern together.
That's Savannah Sasser, executive chef at the Expat in Athens. You can find more on the restaurant at gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over the past few years, Americans have had new opportunities to engage with the unvarnished truth of the nation's history in a number of new museums. Nicole Moore is Manager of Education and Museum Content at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. Nicole, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Amanda Hollowell. She's a community organizer in Savannah. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, good morning.
So I'm wondering, for both of you, did you ever see reflections of yourself at museums when you were growing up?
I grew up in Hawaii, so no.
No.
I grew up in Palm Springs, California, so no.
So how was the African-American experience shown in museums in the past?
In the past, it really depended on where you went. For me, my kind of foray into museums was figuring out how sites talked about slavery and then realizing that we can talk about the houses and we can talk about how beautiful they are and the families, but we never talked about the people responsible. And they were always hidden in the shadows, or they were, you know, just called servants, or just different ways to dance around it. And it never really told the story of the complexity of the institution of slavery, of the people involved, of the different relationships that were there. And I wanted to do something about it because I don't want people going to a site and saying, that's a really beautiful house, but not understanding the craftsman who was enslaved that built that house that still stands.
You've hit on something. I was reading an essay by a woman, African-American woman. She and her husband took a garden tour in the Garden District tour in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And the tour guide talked about the servants. And, you know, they were both scratching their heads and afterwards asked him why he used that term. And he said, well, slaves really upsets people. So you can't say that?
People who use servants instead of saying slaves or enslaved, that's really just at this point a cop out. We know who they were. Call them by their name. If you're not going to use their actual names, then don't sugarcoat it by saying, oh, a servant. That may have been a position that they held, but this was an enslaved human being who had no choice.
The National Memorial for Peace and Justice, commonly known as the Lynching Museum, opened in Alabama. The Civil Rights Museum in Mississippi, National Museum of African American History Museum in D.C., and for the Center for Civil and Human Rights, 2014. Why now, Nicole, do you think so many of these museums are opening?
Because it's time. We've been dancing, as a country, we've been dancing around this topic for a while, and people are saying, oh, well, you know, oh, not now. Well, civil rights, not now. Then we have this, we had Obama, and then they were like, oh, post-racial, that's not a reality. We have to actually talk about why these are such monumental moments for us as a country, instead of it just being who we are. And it's because we never want to talk about slavery, because for a lot of people, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for white families who might have owned slaves. It's embarrassing for some African-Americans who are like, I don't want to talk about that. But that's who we are as a country. And everything that we're going through now can be correlated to the institution of slavery. And until we have those conversations, we're not going to be able to move forward.
Amanda, how about for you? You're a community organizer, so you have, you know, a lot of on-the-ground experience. Are people having these conversations in the communities you work with?
Well, they're trying to. And I think also
a lot more organizers and even myself are using it to explain some of the trauma that even African Americans have in this country. So when you have a museum or an exhibition, I also sit on the Black Heritage Festival in Savannah's planning committee, and this is what we've done for 30 years. We use this as a way to explain the current state of why you see such angst and despair from a community. Hmm. And this is the only way you can actually make it concrete for folks.
Mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. police are going to be required to take a course on critical race theory and visit the National Museum of African American History and Culture was announced. So what do you think, Amanda, that does for the understanding of, you know, it's not just racial sensitivity, it's looking at a full picture.
Right. So you have to understand the community that you're working with and the trauma that's in that community and meet them where they are. And I think that's some of the biggest challenges we have with our policing system, our justice system. I'm really getting tired of the sentence that I hear from folks who say, oh, get over it. How do you get over this?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, there's, you know, when the lynching museum opened, people were like, well, this is in the past. Why dredge up this painful part of history? What's your, you know, Nicole is shaking her head here. What do you say to that?
So my answer is look at the separation of children at the border and then go back and look at slave cartoons. And you will see that America does a great job at repeating some repulsive behavior. So this is important. You can't get over it because we're still participating in this pattern of behavior, just in a different form.
That's Amanda Hollowell. She's a community organizer in Savannah. Nicole Moore is also with me. She's manager of education and museum content. That's at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. Well, Nicole, so what are some of the ways that your organization puts together exhibits that make people feel, make people experience history?
Well, the one thing that we're noted for is the lunch counter exhibit, and that's where it is a simulation of a sit-in protest. And usually when people come through the museum, when they come through the center, they're looking at the exhibits. They're like, oh, okay, you know, this is some reading. I hear about Jim Crow and I see the laws. But then once they sit on the lunch counter, it creates this strong empathetic moment where it's no longer just, oh, I'm reading about this information. I've now interacted and absorbed what happened. And it transforms their experience from just reading about it and being passive to questioning, would this have been me? Could this have happened to me? And what would I have done? And it's once they come off of that lunch counter and they have that moment of empathy, their transitions through the rest of the exhibit changes from just this passive, oh, this is nice to read, to very thought-provoking, how would I have reacted? And it becomes very action-oriented for them. And you see people kind of talking their way through the rest of it. They'll see March on Washington and they're like, yay, this is great. But immediately when we talk about the bombing in Birmingham or Mississippi burning, people are driven back to, could I have gone down to the Deep South to do these things, or how would I have reacted? And that's the draw, and that's what we want them to get, to think about it, and then to take positive action to prevent these things from happening again.
Okay, we've got a little clip here. This is from the Daily Share. You're going to hear visitors recounting their experience at the center's lunch counter.
It was terrifying.
It's just hard to imagine that we could treat another individual that way.
I see you crying.
It was very powerful. I think it was really well done, and you could really feel the very difficult things that people were willing to endure.
Amanda, have you been to sit in at the lunch counter at the center?
I've actually been twice. I was just there recently, about a week ago, with a group called 9 to 5, Georgia's Women Working for Social Justice. And we are a collective of women. So what was interesting was, in my naivete, just about like other cultures' feelings and other people's of color's feelings, we had a large sect of Spanish-speaking Latinx women, and they participated in the lunch counter. And my immediate response was, they're not going to get it, or they're not going to feel the empathy. And when they did the experience, to watch them have a visceral and emotional reaction to it, it actually made me connect with them more, in the sense of, you know, this has probably happened to them recently. Mm-hmm. They've probably had people yell at them and scream at them and say, get out their country and mm-hmm. get out of our country and et cetera. And then when one of the women, I went to console her, and, you know, it was just, she just held my hand, and then watching her reaction, I was like, okay, so even more so, I need to make sure that we're connecting our trauma with each other so we understand how we're all connected in this movement, because we can run through this in silos. Mm-hmm. And I think that could be, that's one of the biggest challenges right now in community organizing. So many people have their one issue that they want to stand by, but they don't understand the interconnectivity of each of all the issues amongst all of us.
So that is a deeply felt experience. It's so different from learning in a history class or reading in a book. But this is the question. I mean, people who want to know the truth will go to those museums. Mm-hmm. People who are clinging to old myths about, you know, what America is will not. Mm-hmm. So are museums helping to create genuine dialogue about the history of Black Americans? I mean, if you're not reaching those populations.
We are. As a community, as the museum field, we are doing more purposeful work. It's not just about diversity and inclusion anymore. It's about really telling the narratives that people weren't hearing before. That's the inclusive piece. It's no longer just saying, oh, we're going to do this or that. It's we're going to tell these particular stories. We're going to give history a holistic view versus the lens that we've always seen. Take, for instance, this weekend at Monticello, they just opened the exhibit on Sally Hemings. That's a permanent exhibit. That is a permanent challenging exhibit that changes mm-hmm. an entire narrative of how this country was founded in the man that wrote the Independence document, how we look at him. And that is their drive to say, we need to look at this from a different angle. Here is this woman. Here's this child who becomes a woman in this household. Let's talk about her, her family, that legacy, and let's face it head on.
Can you imagine right. that happening at, you know, all these colonial villages and antebellum mansions? I mean, is that on the way that people are confronting the truth?
It really depends on their boards.
Let's see, Amanda, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, well, in Savannah, we have, like, we're a wedding destination as well. Mm-hmm. And lately, there's just been this trend of non-people of color saying, oh, I want to do a plantation wedding. And I'm like, no, you do not want to do a plantation wedding. But do you see how we can, like, look at history in rose-colored glasses? So, mm-hmm. yes, like, I'm going to go defer to Nicole. It's the board, and it's actually saying, like, can I confront this mm-hmm. part of history in an eloquent way that people get it and are offended?
Yeah. Well, and it is a business. I mean, I'm looking at figures. Mandela Research says $48 billion annually in African-American tourism. So mm-hmm. there are people out there spending money that could come to these mm-hmm. museums. How is attendance? Do you know any figures on those, Nicole? Like, how's it doing? I remember when the National Museum opened in Washington, there were lines out the door for weeks.
I mean, I think it's on an uprise, especially now in today's climate. People are yearning to learn more about a different side of history. And so you have more people coming into institutions like the Center or the Smithsonian, and they are trying to find out those other pieces. And we are the source for that. So I think, unfortunately, as this climate continues politically, we're going to see more people coming to these institutions because they're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I didn't learn this in school. And it's like, you did a little bit, but here's a chance for you to really dive into it.
That is Nicole Moore. She's manager of education and museum content at the Center for Civil and Human Rights here in Atlanta. Thank you so much for being with us. And Amanda Hollowell, community organizer in Savannah. Thank you, Amanda, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Georgia's Secure, Accessible, and Fair Elections, or SAFE, Commission is preparing to recommend replacements for the state's outdated and insecure election system. GPB's Stephen Fowler got to take a look at some of the options the commission is considering and brings us back this report.
At the Georgia Freight Depot in downtown Atlanta, lawmakers and laymen alike huddled around stacks of paper and gleaming touchscreens. It feels a little bit like a book fair in here. There are five different vendors set up around the room. The vendors are Clear Ballot, Dominion, ES&S, Hart InterCivic, and Smartmatic. All of them are vying to replace Georgia's 27,000 16-year-old direct recording electronic machines. Each of the proposed systems use some sort of paper trail to record and count your votes. And to learn more, I gave all of them a try. All right, so I'm walking up to the first table here. It's clear ballot. And now, what am I doing?
Okay, so this is a digital scan voting system, which means...
Bill Murphy with Clear Ballot walks me through the process. I bubble in my choices on a hand-marked paper ballot, which is then fed into a scanner to be counted. Murphy says his company offers transparency with elections because their software captures an image of every vote cast, not just a final tally of results.
We're showing you every voted mark, we're showing you how we interpreted it, and we're showing you the full ballot in a click of a mouse so you can make decisions.
That means elections officials have more flexibility to visually discern what a voter did when they filled out the ballot. Hart InterCivic has a similar system that takes a picture of the ballot to ensure votes are preserved, plus a touchscreen ballot marking device that prints your results on paper. The only company that did not have a hand-marked paper ballot demonstration was ES&S. Their machines are similar to how we vote now. Get your voter card, touch the screen to cast your votes, but once you're done, the machine prints a paper record of your votes and a series of barcodes. The barcodes are then scanned and the ballot falls down into a locked box. Looks kind of like a trash can, and the memory device on the machine tabulates the votes once polls close. Many activist groups in attendance have concerns about votes being counted via barcode, or in the case of Dominion System, a QR code. Marilyn Marks runs the nonprofit Coalition for Good Governance and advocates for purely hand-marked paper ballots. She says there's no way to accurately conduct a recount or audit results on machines that use barcodes or QR codes because voters can't know that their choices were correctly scanned. Because,
yeah, the barcodes are printed on a piece of paper, but that doesn't make them auditable just because they're on a piece of paper. You know, you and I can't read a barcode.
The final vendor, Smartmatic, says what voters can read is a text printout of who they voted for in each contest. After you make your selections, a paper slip with your vote drops down in a window next to the screen. The text on that slip is then scanned into their system to be counted. Smartmatic says recounts could be done by reading the text as well. One thing all the systems had in common? The capability to display one election contest on the screen at a time. It's part of the most recent guidelines put out by the Federal Election Assistance Commission to improve functionality, accessibility, and security of the voting process. But Smartmatic's Ed Smith says whether that and other guidelines end up in the final product is up to Georgia.
They're not voluntary in that we can't opt out of them, but different states can opt out of them because the Constitution sets election power at the state level, not at the federal level.
Incoming Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger says the day's demonstrations are key to guiding the bipartisan Secure, Accessible, and Fair Elections Commission.
So we're looking at all the technologies that are out there, all the platforms, to see what's out there. And then obviously the SAFE Commission will be finishing up shortly, hopefully offering some recommendations.
The commission will present its final report to lawmakers later this month. Raffensperger hopes to select a new system and have it fully in place for the 2020 election. For GPB News, I'm Stephen Fowler in Atlanta.
And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our engineer. Don Smith is our dean of grammar. And Amy Kiley is senior producer. You can join the conversation. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.